Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find everything that we record as part of our Learning College of Vanguard Audiobooks at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to talk about Tammany Hall, as it was 100 years ago, and Henry Ford and the International Jew has two chapters on it as part of his The International Jew, the World's Foremost Problem, all about anti-gentilism on the part of the Jews and how they dominated back then, 100 years ago in America, from what I'm reading to you at the very end of, tail end of 2015, just about to move into 2016. Tammany Hall was controlled by the Irish for a long time, and it became synonymous with political corruption in the U.S., but his point is going to be that the Jews came in and took it over while retaining some of the Goy fronts or the Gentile fronts. Spokespeople like Tim Sullivan, they were the real powers there. And he even says at the end it was the same up in Boston. He's got two chapters on it, so we'll do them both together. These are chapters 53 and 54 of 80 that make up the series of articles that ran in the Dearborn Independent, published back in 1920 and 21. So let's dig in and see what he says. How the Jews ruled and ruined Tammany Hall. How the Jews ruled and ruined Tammany Hall. Tammany Hall is the city power in New York City, famously depicted as a locus of corruption by cartoonist Thomas Nast, who was of German descent. He was the famous political cartoonist who gave the Republican Democratic parties their animal symbols. There were the donkey or the jackass and the elephant. He did a lot of excellent works. Anyway, how the Jews ruled and ruined Tammany Hall. Within the memory, even of young men, Tammany Hall has been the synonym of all political trickery and the vocabulary of popular criticism. Tammany Hall was held up as the worst example of boss rule and political corruption that it was possible to find in either of the parties. Its very name became a stigma. But even the most unobservant newspaper reader must have observed the gradual fading out of Tammany Hall from public comment, the cessation of bitter criticism, the entire absence of headlines bristling with ugly charges, and the calling of the hosts of good citizenship to do battle against the grim bossism that maintained its headquarters at the Wigwam. Why this change? Is it due to the dying out of Tammany Hall as a political force? No, Tammany is still there, as any New York politician will tell you. Is it due, then, to a reform of that organization? No, the Tammany Tiger has not changed its stripes. Then perhaps this change is due to public sentiment. Not at all. The explanation is to be found along other lines. There was a time when fearless publications told the truth about Tammany, but Harper's Weekly and others which waged fierce war against the Tiger have either gone out of existence or have fallen under control of the Jews. The silence which has shrouded certain matters must be noted and set aside without reference to the changed control of the press. There was a time when public bodies like the Citizens Union, organized to oppose Tammany and to keep a volunteer vigil on its activities. These groups have succumbed to Jewish contributions and officership and no longer stand guard. The Jews co-opt the press, they co-opt the citizens' groups. Anything they're let into, if they don't create a front themselves, will enter an existing group and co-opt it for their own purposes. That's why you have to exclude them, or else they will take over, because they have the money in the organization and the natural conspiring genetic quality that we seem to lack, so that excluding them is an absolute necessity. The outcry against Tammany seemed to be hushed at the moment the Tammany patronage fell into the hands of New York Jews, where it now reposes, the Kahilla being the real political center, and we've heard about the Kahilla in earlier chapters, and Tammany but a distributing station, a sort of organizational, quote, Gentile front, unquote, for the more powerful Kahilla. Kahilla is the organization of the Jews in exile, the most powerful Kahilla in the world. Kahilla in the world outside of Russia, or perhaps even including Russia, would be the Jews in America organizing the Kahilla. And as he said in earlier chapters, they organized the government that would take over Russia after the Communist Revolution was organized out of New York City. And he also said very ominously, they have a government in waiting for governing America, too, should they come into complete overt control. A few Tammany leaders are permitted to strut out in front, but everyone knows that from the wigwam chiefs the power has departed. It is now to be found in Jewish conferences. Murphy is still the titular head of Tammany, but like a Samson shorn, he is not feared and obeyed as of yore. In fact, the Judaization of Tammany Hall is now complete. Once in a while the Irish, always a match for the Jews, rear their heads and show battle, but for the most part Jewish money rules and the tiger lies down. Tammany Hall was one of the strongest political organizations ever seen in the United States, potent not only in municipal and state politics, but often exercising a decisive influence on national affairs. It was, without exaggeration, powerful. If there is one quality that attracts Jews, it is power. Wherever the seat of power may be, thither they swarm obsequiously. As Tammany was power and the gate of power, it was natural that the Jews of the biggest American city in the world should court it. Doubtless they were also affected by the incongruity of the fact that in the biggest Jewish city, the most solid political power was non-Jewish. That was a condition that called for correction. When the German Jewish banker Schoenberg came to this country under the name of August Belmont to represent the interests of the Rothschilds, his keen eye at once took in the situation, and at once he began to court the favor of Tammany. So you have the rich Jew financier in Europe, the Rothschild, deputes his man Schoenberg, S-C-H-O-E-N-B-E-R-G, who goes under the goy-sounding August Belmont. And Belmont sees, oh, there's real power in Tammany, and worms his way in. He became a member and a supporter. It was good business for this Jewish banker because the funds of the Rothschilds were heavily invested in New York tractions. The properties of city tractions were, and to a great extent still are, as in all American cities, at the mercy of the local Tammany power, by whatever name it may be known. Belmont was insinuating himself under the wing of the power to protect the investments for which he was responsible. August Belmont eventually attained the coveted eminence of Grand Sachem of the Tammany Society. The Belmont family for a time represented the sole Jewish banking support of Tammany Hall, but that honor is now divided among many. In Richard Croker's day, when corruption went hand in hand with power, and power apparently was none the weaker for it, we find that this notorious leader's intimate friend, business partner, and political associate was a Jew. Richard Croker's associate was a Jew, Andrew Friedman, F-R-E-E-D-M-A-N. Friedman and Croker lived together at the Democratic Club in Fifth Avenue, Tammany politicians even then having become rich enough to despise 14th Avenue. Friedman held the purse strings of the organization as head of the Committee on Finance, and he was Croker's representative and mouthpiece when the chief went into exile on an overseas estate. The most recent Jewish power in Tammany Hall, and one of the more liberal contributors to Tammany campaign funds, is the lawyer Samuel Untermyer, whose specialty of recent years seems to be to serve as the battering ram of the Jewish power against interests which it once destroyed, and whose efforts are usually camouflaged under exaggerated journalistic advertisements as being wholly in the public interest. So whatever the powerful Jews want is represented as the public interest. Mr. Untermyer is not in particularly good humor with Tammany these days because of the recent defeat of his son, Irving Untermyer, for a judgeship. Irving Murray, Lou Ellen, these are Anglo names that Jews adopted to appear upper class. There was somewhere a slip. The Jews deserted the Wilsonship anyway, apparently seeing what was coming in the way of retribution for the colossal and amazing mismanagement of the war business, which was principally in their hands. And in the ensuing mix-up, a scion of the House of Untermyer tasted defeat. Tammany numbers other Jews among its supporters. Nathan Strauss, with one S, S-T-R-A-U-S, one of the owners of R.H. Macy & Company, started by a Scotsman, bought out by a Jew, has been for years an active member of the organization and one of the rulers of its inner councils. A Jewish ghetto politician, Henry M. Goldfogel, has represented the Jewish interests in Congress for a number of years and expected to continue, but he slipped in the election and has recently been taken care of by a city appointment. There is also Judge Rosalsky, who has been implicated in a number of interesting matters which illustrate the completeness of the Jewish network of control in New York City. One might mention also M.L. Erlanger and Worley Platzek, justices of the Supreme Court of the state of New York. But if one began a list of the Jewish judiciary of that city, where would one end? Another Tammanyite is Randolph Guggenheimer, founder of the first corporation law firm of Guggenheimer, Untermeyer, and Marshall, Untermeyer being the aforesaid Grand Inquisitor of Gentile activities generally, and Marshall being the head of the American Jewish Committee and the Kehillah. It was doubtless necessary for a Jewry that contemplated control of the judiciary as well as special protection for certain powerful Jewish enterprises that are near enough to the borderline of the law to merit question. It was necessary to obtain control of the supreme political engine through which favors were dispersed in local politics. And control of such organizations can always be had by money. So they have to control the judiciary. They have to control the politics in order that their various financial swindles and their white slaving and their bootlegging go more or less unmolested. And control of such organizations can always be had by money. Not that the Jews threw themselves entirely into Tammany. The Jew's natural political home seems to be in the Republican Party, for thither he returns after venture elsewhere. But his predilection for the Republican Party does not move the Jew to make the mistake of being exclusively the partisan of one group. It is better, as he knows, to control both groups. As a matter of political fact, strong as is the Jewish element in Tammany, it is still stronger in the ranks of the Republican Party, while New York socialism is completely headed and manned by Jews. This renders it extremely easy for the Jews to swing support in whichever direction they choose, and for Kehillah to fulfill any threat it may make. It also ensures that any Jewish candidate on any ticket will be elected. The fluke in the case of young Untermeyer is perhaps not to be entirely explained politically. Other causes were doubtless working in that matter. It is a long time since Ferdinand Levy bore the distinction of being the first Jew in New York to hold a political job. He was only a coroner, and the man who appointed him was only a fire commissioner, but the fire commissioner was Richard Croker, and Levy was solidly backed by the independent order of B'nai B'rith, whose success in this matter laid the foundation for more ambitious demands later. But at the beginning, the Kehillah Jews adopted the ancient policy not of putting forward their own people, but non-Jews who could be useful to Judah. The difference between pro-Jewish politicians who were not themselves Jews and politicians of the Jewish race is that the former in office can sometimes go further than the Jew in office can without detection. So they like Gentile fronts because they protect what's going on. They protect them against Gentiles seeing the game afoot. This has been true at least up to this time, but it will probably not be true very long now that the people's eyes are being opened. The Jewish office holder is only standing for his race, but the Gentile front has betrayed the people in for the pottage of Jewish favor. So these are the conservatives, the sellouts, the traitors, the career girls. Thus, in the early days of Tammany, indeed, until comparatively recent years, we see the Gentile front in Tammany offices and basking in the control of Tammany publicity, but in the background there is always his Jewish control. This also is a formula for citizens who wish to know the meanings of things otherwise unexplainable. Look for the Jewish control. To this end, therefore, the Jews have been strong in all parties, so that whichever way the election went, the Jews would win. In New York, it is always the Jewish party that wins. The campaign is staged as an entertainment, a diversion for the people. They are permitted to think and act as if they were really making their own government, but it is always the Jews that win. So campaigns as elections and diversions, but the reality of political control is behind the scenes via Jewish money. And if after having elected their man or group, obedience is not rendered to the Jewish control, then you speedily hear of scandals and investigations and impeachments for the removal of the disobedient official. Usually a man with a past proves the most obedient instrument, but even a good man can often be tangled up in campaign practices that compromise him. It has been commonly known that Jewish manipulation of campaign matters has been so skillfully handled that no matter which candidate was elected, there was ready-made a sufficient amount of evidence to discredit him in cases Jewish managers needed to discredit him. To arrange this is part of the thoroughness of Jewish control. And of course, the American people have been sufficiently trained to roar against the public official immediately the first Jewish political hound emits its warning bay. So if the Jew sets up a cry in one of his newspapers, the well-trained public docilely goes along. Amazing as it is, the technique of the Jewish political process, the readiness with which the American people can be counted on to do their part in forwarding the game is still more amazing. What Mr. Hyland, the present mayor of New York, has done to merit chastisement is scarcely clear to a nonpartisan investigator, but the fact that the Jews have set out to get him for something is evident on every side. In the Untermeyer so-called housing investigation, the people hauled up were non-Jews, and the result of the whole business has been a stronger Jewish hold than ever on the housing affairs of New York. Jews are exempt from such inquisitions. The choice prey are non-Jewish business houses whose secrets may be forced and whose good name may be stained under cover of a legal procedure. There is such a thing as a blackmail so entirely respectable as to be unsuspected. Governor Sulzer of New York was the choice of the Jews. They subscribed money for his campaign, forced it on him, and kept careful account of it. Finally, under pressure of a compelling sense of justice, Sulzer pardoned a non-Jewish valet of an important Jewish New York family, a young man whom a coterie of Jews very prominent in the political, financial, and social worlds had contrived to, quote, put away, unquote, for a period of 30 years. Sulzer had no option but to pardon young Brandt, B-R-A-N-D-T, German name, but he paid the penalty. He was impeached. The Jews who supported him testified against him, and their checks were used to assist his dismissal. The story of young Brandt hangs heavily over the heads of some of the proudest Jewish names in New York. So again, as we always see, as was the case with the ADL founded to protect Leo Frank, all that matters to them is that the person in question is a Jew, and the lowest Jew is higher than the highest goyim. That's how they look at it. It's a racial thing. They truly are a racial team, whereas we are competing with them as individuals without even being aware that they have a team. How pathetic is that? Playing on both sides of the political fence and always retaining a string on the men they elect to office are two Jewish characteristics which should not fail to be reckoned with. The Dearborn Independent, in its recent article showing the hand of Paul Warburg in the Federal Reserve System, was able to prove by Mr. Warburg's own words that his firm, Kuhn Loeb & Company, during the three-cornered fight between Roosevelt, Taft, and Wilson, supported all three. So Jews always bet on every horse in the race so that they always win. Just as whatever you want to buy, they're always there to sell you, even if it's Nazism, you understand. You have to take that into account. They must be excluded. The Jewish owners of R.H. Macy & Company, New York, illustrate the same principle. While Nathan Strauss looked after affairs at Tammany Hall, his brother and partner Isidore Strauss was one of the most active opponents of Tammany. Were the interests of the two men therefore different? Not at all. Take the firm of Guggenheimer, Untermeyer, and Marshall. This is a notable firm for the part it plays in the people's business. Every community in America has been affected by Louis Marshall's decisions as the head of the American Jewish Committee. Untermeyer is the arch-inquisitor of Jewry. Randolph Guggenheimer, the founder of the firm, achieved the foremost influence of any except the chief in the old wigwam, and was a power to be reckoned with in all matters. But Louis Marshall is a staunch Republican and a member of the Republican Club. Here again is a favorite method of including all parties under the capacious wing of the Jewish program. Hence the popularity of, quote, fusion, unquote, capital F, in New York City elections. It has become the fad, but its most notable purpose is to ensure the election of a Jew, whatever his politics may be. In some assembly districts, it is impossible to find anyone but a Jew to vote for. When Otto A. Rosalsky, a jurist who was implicated in the Brandt scandal, was re-elected judge of General Sessions in 1920, he was the, quote, fusion, unquote, candidate on both the Democratic and Republican tickets. It was perhaps fortunate for his candidacy that he was. The point just now is that whenever a candidate may be vulnerable, it is very desirable to forestall a fight upon him by eliminating all opposition before the election. Fusion is another matter that should be carefully scrutinized in behalf of American rule of American cities. By the way things are going in New York, these inter-party and fusion expedients may soon be unnecessary because, in any event, it will become most difficult to avoid electing a Jew. Of the candidates of all parties for the offices of Justice of the Supreme Court of New York, numbering 26, 14 were Jews. Of the Democratic presidential electors, 13 were Jews. Of the Republican presidential electors, 14 were Jews. Of the Socialist presidential electors, 22 were Jews. The strength of Tammany had exactly the same strength as the source as the strength of the Cahilla, namely, in the foreign population. Masses of foreign Irish originally, then masses of Jews. The difference being that the Cahilla had a more compact foreign mass to draw upon. But both the Jewish leaders and the Tammany leaders have always been alertly aware of the fact, and you see this in the movie The Gangs of New York, if you want to see a depiction of some of this. But both the Jewish leaders and the Tammany leaders have always been alertly aware of the fact that their power depended upon an uninterrupted flow of immigration to supply the losses sustained by the Americanization of the people. It is always the un-Americanized foreigner that makes the best material for the Cahilla's and Tammany's purposes. The Cahilla is based upon the principle of recognizing racial minorities, and Tammany has made a specialty of giving representation of racial minorities in its councils. This was a liberal policy and was thoroughly American in its original intent, as Tammany was a thoroughly American assemblage at its inception, but it was soon seized upon by the Jews and used to their own ends, and to the eventual ruin of all except Jewish representation. Thus, all through the history of immigration activity, Tammany has been on the side of the wide-open gate without any restrictions. The lower the type of immigrant, the more easily amenable it is to the ward boss's orders. Tammany of recent years has been the able seconder of the Cahilla in all efforts to frustrate control of immigration. The third great influx of immigration into the United States occurred in 1884 and was really the cause of the beginning of the degeneration of Tammany Hall. The Great Wave was composed of Russian, Austrian, and Hungarian Jews, whose arrival was followed by a memorable period of crime, the marks of which remain to this day. Indeed, the downfall of Richard Croker was a direct result. At that time, the police department and the police courts, before which all criminal cases in the city were first brought, were in the hands of Tammany Hall. The result was a partnership between local government and crime, which has not been duplicated outside of Semitic countries. Immigrant Jews of the shadier type organized an association called the Max Hochstim Association, H-O-C-H-S-T-I-M, which was known during the Lexow investigation as the Essex Market Court Gang. One of its chief rulers was Martin Engel, Tammany leader of the 8th Assembly District. The king of this Jewish district, so-called, in quotes, was a man named Solomon, who had changed his name to the less revealing one of Smith, and who became known as Silver Dollar Smith because of the fact that he ruled his little empire from the Silver Dollar Saloon, which gained its name from the silver dollars that were cemented into the floor of his place of business. This saloon was just opposite the Essex Market Court, which was thronged daily by hordes of Yiddish criminals, the bondsmen, false witnesses, and lawyers. Let not the fastidious reader deem it unnecessary to linger longer round the old police court at Essex Market, for out therefrom came a word which has fixed itself in common English speech, the term shyster, by which a certain type of lawyer is described. A Clinton Street lawyer named Scheuster, S-C-H-E-U-S-T-E-R, or Scheuster or Scheister pronounced. In German it would be Scheuster, it might be Scheister in Yiddish, but it became Scheister in English in any case. A Clinton Street lawyer named Schoister, whose practices were quite characteristic, made himself very obnoxious to Justice Osborne. Whenever another Yiddish lawyer attempted a shady trick, the judge would openly denounce it as, quote, Schoister practice. And so it came that the first men in the profession to bear the name Schoister were the Yiddish lawyers of Essex Market Court. To make a nasty story brief, the Max Hochstim Association became the first organized white slaver group in America, and the revelations made by the Lexow Committee are shuddering glimpses into that lowest form of depravity, a coolly conducted, commercialized, consolidated traffic in women. The traffic was made to yield dividends to politicians, to Tammany Jews in particular. The ghetto became the red light district of New York, the first man to undertake the export trade in women with foreign countries, especially South America, was a man who later became a Tammany notable. So understand the big picture here. America has always never had many Jews in it until after 1880, a bunch of Jews pour in. And these Jews pour in tremendous numbers. And we've already heard how Jews poisoned our relations with Russia and reversed treaties and ignored the law in any case. All these huge masses of Jews are pouring into New York City, and they're all co-located, and they're setting up these unions so that they can do political radicalism while they're working on their trade garments, you know, various garment district employees. And at the same time, you've got this the beginning of the rise of organized crime and all these Jewish gangsters, and you have the Jews also moving into the law schools and the City College of New York and becoming lawyers and then politicians and using all of their newfound wealth in this land of milk and honey to buy up the judgeships, to buy the politicians, to become the lawyers, the judges, politicians themselves, to become the owners of the retail shops that advertise in the papers, to organize their own kahilla, their governance in exile, in the diaspora, and take over all the existing native forms. Before the Jews were there, we had advertising, we had newspapers, we had politicians, we even had corruption, but it was all homegrown stuff, or at the most, it was Irish immigrants. The Jews came in and redid all this, and they started up even worse stuff, the prohibition, the gangsterism, the murder for hire, the hitmen, and the white slaving he's talking about, as well as the building up Wall Street and financial swindles there, which we've heard about earlier. So this is the basic context here. This is a type, very foreign to Anglo-American types, that has never been in America before in any kind of numbers, and now it is, and this is the result. And at this point in time, 100 years ago, our people weren't so conditioned to it that they didn't regard it as normal, but they regarded it, the ones who understood it, as shocking, as horrible, and they moved to educate their people about it, just as I'm doing to you, Henry Ford did back then 100 years ago, but with he had a lot more confidence than I could have today because the Jews were not then as powerful as they are today, although they were extremely powerful, and he thought that mere exposure would tend to get the problems that they caused cleaned up, but we now know that that is not enough, in fact. So Jews are responsible for the first white slavery in America. He says, Ford, the surprising fact is that although these matters are written in official documents, and although the same matters have been written into the record of every similar investigation which has been made, Jewish leaders persist in denying that the leaders in this particular form of depravity, white slavery, are Jews. Jews deny that they run white slaving, but they do. When the United States government made a nationwide investigation, it found and recorded the same facts. The New York Kahilla came into existence as a defense organization at a time when the exposure of the Jewish white slave traffic threatened to overwhelm the New York ghetto. So there's a curious parallel to the ADL. The New York Kahilla comes into being to protect the Jews engaged in white slaving, just as the ADL came into existence to defend Leo Frank, a pedophile and a murderer of a white girl, Mary Fagan. The Max Hochstim Association was not the only organization of its kind. The other was the New York Independent Benevolent Association, which was organized in 1896 by a party of Jewish white slave dealers as they were returning from the funeral of Sam Engel, brother of Martin Engel, Tammany leader of the Red Light District. So, Max Hochstim Association and the New York Independent Benevolent Association are two Jew white slaver formal organizations. And let me run and grab a book here real quick. And now this was a book I got for Miller in his defense, but I wasn't able to send it to him because of the rules they had, and he had books from other people. But anyway, The Rise and the Fall of the Jewish Gangster in America is going to cover some of the territory he's talking about here, and I've read some of it myself, and it just, if you want a book that talks about Jewish hitmen and Jewish involvement in white slavery and what that was like, this was written by a Jew. Revised edition, Albert Fried, Columbia University Press. This is from, what year, 1980. Yeah, it talks about all this. So again, The Rise and the Fall of the Jewish Gangster in America is very instructive on these matters. And now, in particular, what we're going to hear about in this paragraph. So he says, the gangs that form the background of, again, you're talking about New York and the different areas on the island, and it's super congested, and these are hundreds and thousands and millions of Jews. Tenements, you know, very cramped, nasty. Life is with people, and just a very low elements that are coming over from Russia and are very, very uncivilized and feral and willing to do anything to make a buck. The gangs that formed the backbone of the Tammany power in the slum districts were made up of, quote, cadets, unquote. Their principal field of operation was the cheap dance halls. Paul Kelly's gang, Paul Kelly is a Jew, not an Irishman, originated in the halls about Lower Broadway. Monk Eastman's gang grew strong in the Russian Jewish district below Delancey Street. And Kid Twist's gang developed close to a dance hall for Galician Jews on the Far East Side. All of these three were Jewish gang leaders. They were slavers as their forebears were in the days of Rome's decline. They were bootleggers before the days of Prohibition. And they constituted a strong support of the international narcotic ring, which to this day has defied the law by corrupting officers of the law. So, drugs, drink, and prostitution. The Jews are dominating all these vices in New York City. It was to associations like these that the Lights of Tammany lent their names. Tim Sullivan was a vice president of the Max Hochstim Association. The name of the Honorable Henry M. Goldfogel also appeared on the picnic announcements. The exposure which resulted when the white people of New York finally succeeded in getting the forces of law to function impartially for a little while caused many of the implicated Jews to change their names. These names are now representative of some of the best Jewish families, whose concealed bar sinister is the fact that the foundation of the family fortune was laid in the red light district. Society, sliced down to its seeds, is a queer growth. It is due injustice to say that men like Tim Sullivan were not the originators of the Jewish abuses referred to, nor willing participants in the gains therefrom. Tammany would do favors for its friends at the police court or elsewhere. Tammany had its occasional political upheavals. Tammany believed that they who profited by political spoils should divide with the wigwam's treasury. But with such traffic as seduction and barter in women, Tammany had never been compromised until the Yiddish invasion of New York and the Judaization of the wigwam. This much must be said for the Irish and American leaders. The situation is the same in Boston. An Irish city, its chief political control is in the hands of Jews. The old-time Irish leaders are still permitted to be out in front, but the inner power has departed from them. One Boston ward, where once none but Irish lived, now contains only Jews. But the old-time Irish boss retains his seat. This is by favor of the Jews and nothing else. The same state of facts accounts in large degree for the connection between a man like Tim Sullivan and the Jews. Tim, as everyone knew him, was the leader of a district inhabited by Irish and Germans. Then the Jews came in, and then began the Jews' practice of profiting by the people's dislike of them. Foreign Jews well know that they are disliked. It is one of their assets which never fails to produce dividends. They choose the part of the city where they desire to live, and a few move in. Their immediate neighbors move out. More Jews move in. More of the others move out. The property nearest the Jews always goes down in value. People will sell at a loss rather than live engulfed in a ghetto. It was so in Tim Sullivan's district. As the Jews swarmed in, the Irish and Germans fled north. Sullivan stood his ground. It was his old territory. And he would not leave it. So Tim Sullivan is representative of the old school, and as the Jews come in and the Irish and Germans that he presided over leave for the north, the suburbs, whatever, Sullivan stood his ground. It was his old territory. He would not leave it nor remove his family. He cultivated the new arrivals and made a partnership with the ex-kosher chicken butcher, Martin Engel. The Jews lived under Sullivan's rule for a time, awaiting the moment when they should know what to do for themselves. The Yiddish flood increased until the district was crowded, and then the Jews demanded representation for themselves. With a premonition that a new force had arisen, Tim Sullivan played safe and helped the Jews to get recognition. Martin Engel was made the leader of the Old Eighth. But Sullivan had previously gone to Tammany, or to what remained of the old non-Jewish Tammany, and exacted an understanding that his rule should be left unchanged below 14th Street. From that time forward, in spite of the understanding, Sullivan's power began to wane, principally because he continued to get in deeper and deeper with the Jews. He went into Jewish lines of business. He formed a theatrical partnership with George Krauss, among his enterprises being the Imperial Music Hall, the Dewey Theater, and the Traveling Eagle Burlesque Company. Still, the old district continued to become more crowded and overcrowded and saturated with Yiddish newcomers for whom neither the name Sullivan nor the traditions of the district had any meaning. In his closing years, scarcely more than a hanger-on around the former scene of his power, Tim Sullivan bitterly lamented the ease with which he was led into associations that undermined his power. Croker was destroyed in public confidence by the terrific shock of the exposure attending the Jewish cadet activities. Sullivan, equally picturesque, was the slowly shoved-out victim of Jewish infiltration. There were other occurrences and other downfalls, all of which are part of the real story of Tammany. That appeared in 24 September 1921, and was the shows how the Jews started to come into New York and take power for themselves. And then we'll move on to the next chapter, which is associated, which is chapter 54. Jew Wires Direct Tammany's Gentile Puppets. Begins with an epigraph from Norman Hapgood, quote, "I need hardly explain that I do not think Jews ought to insist overmuch on their rights or nationality in a negative sense. They ought to be as much Jews as they can, but ought to be as little as possible of what is merely anti-Christian. For the Jews to try to get a song out of the public schools because it praises Jesus is natural, but perhaps hardly wise. I admit that question, however, is an extremely complex and baffling one. Again, the Jews have naturally taken a great interest in this war, but in that case, also, they ought to choose as far as possible the more tolerant view. Too much hostility to Russia was shown, it seems to me, when some of their spokesmen were fighting over the wording of the Immigration Act. They seem to be fighting not for a real gain, but simply to rub their political power in America into the Russian mind." And so, chapter 54, Jew Wires Direct Tammany's Gentile Puppets. The proposal that non-Jews emigrate from New York City, 500,000 in the first exodus and 500,000 in the second, to hasten the event which is held to be a certain occurrence, namely that New York shall become an all-Jewish city, may be a joke, but it is no joke that the Jews themselves discuss and have proposed that the city of New York be separated from the state of New York and made both a state and a city in itself. This would entail three governments, state, county, and municipal, whose offices the Jews could parcel out as they pleased. Besides, it would rid them of Albany. It is a most amazing fact that the state capital, as bad as it is, has always been able to defeat the New York Jew in his more ardently pursued quests, as notably his insistent appeal to abrogate the Sunday law, which we've heard about in earlier chapters. Of course, if the non-Jews emigrated from New York, the Jews would soon follow. They are not self-sufficient. If New York could be isolated, Jewish initiative would not suffice to provide enough potatoes for the inhabitants. It is too trite to say that New York is already in the hands of the Jews, but it would be most startling to give a schedule illustrating how completely this is so. The New Yorker himself can scarcely comprehend the extent of his vassalage to the Jew. The average intelligent New Yorker does not know what the Kehillah is, nor yet how it works. Like a child born within the sound of Niagara Falls, the New Yorker takes Jewish supremacy as a matter of course, as the way things should be, and as the way they probably are elsewhere. The New Yorker is thus like a native of the Balkans. The Hylan, H-Y-L-A-N, administration, ostensibly non-Jewish, is really Jewish, as any New York administration must necessarily be, except there should arise a man whose ambition would be to prove that New York could be better governed if the Jews should be excluded from the government. Well-informed New Yorkers say that the power of Hylan is Hirschfeld. This is a rather peculiar situation to those who do not understand how the Jewish leaders work. Directly, you say the Hylan administration is Jewish. It is objected, but it is the arch-Jewish inquisitor Untermeyer who is trying to break down the Hylan administration. Exactly. That is the game. It's inside and outside that does it. There is power gained in both making them, and there is power gained in breaking them. And often it is profitable to try both ways with the same man. That is the way Russia went. There were Jews plentifully sprinkled throughout the government of Russia, in spite of the quote-unquote persecution, and there were Jews outside it. Between the two, they got Russia. It is the same in a Texas city today. Four non-Jewish candidates for postmaster were made the center of a political deadlock. Up through the deadlock pops a Jew as a compromise candidate for all sections. A sufficient number of Jews were available in that city to keep all non-Jewish candidates in a deadlock until their own man was trotted out. Now, this is important. The Gentile mind, quote-unquote, the Gentile mind, of course, does not easily realize these turnings and twistings of group conspiracy. And that is why the Jews feel safe, as a rule. They rely on what they call Gentile stupidity. The Gentile says, incredible. And the traditional Jewish game is incredible, until by mountainous proofs and centuries of illustration, the actuality of it is forced home to the mind. Goyim just don't think the way Jews do, thus they're not naturally disposed even to entertain thoughts, and if you provide them with a mountain of proof, they still have difficulty believing it. But to return to the New York City government, the police department has its Jewish streak in the higher offices, a Jewish police commissioner who has fortunately escaped thus far the full story of his career. The Department of Health, where it actually touches the people, is Jewish, although occasionally a distinguished non-Jewish name meets the eye in the roster of the higher officials. The public health is becoming more and more a Jewish monopoly in our cities. The Department of Accounts, the Board of Child Welfare, the Board of Inebriety, the Municipal Service Commission, the Board of Taxes and Assessments are all under the leadership and domination of Jews. The judiciary becomes increasingly Jewish, litigation is almost overwhelmingly Jewish, and the consequences to the reputation of the courts of justice and the profession of law are well understood. Real estate exploitation and speculation is strictly Jewish, the profiteers treating even their own co-nationalists with the utmost cruelty. In short, New York's most influential press within New York is the Yiddish press. New York's real government is the Yiddish Kehillah. New York's real administration of the law is the Yiddish administration. New York's real politics is Jewish. A little more, New York's official language would be the Yiddish dialect. In all this, Tammany Hall is little more than a name. It is one of the rallying centers which the Jews have left the non-Jew who still interests himself in New York politics. There must be rallying places for the non-Jews, and one or two do not hurt. The Jew has the double advantage in such a matter, for while he claims equality with all, he denies equality with any. That is, any Jew proclaims his right to join any fraternity or any club or any society or any party whose members are chiefly non-Jewish, but where is the Jewish fraternity or club or society that admits non-Jewish members? The newspapers carried the report, after a certain occurrence, that hundreds of Jews had offered to join the Knights of Columbus. It is very typical of Jewish character. But let any non-Jew attempt to join B'nai B'rith or the Hebrew Young Men's Association or the Menorah Society or any of the others, he will see how far the principle of equality operates. We want to be part of yours, but we want our own for ourselves, is the Jewish attitude. So, politically, the New York Jew has the advantage. He belongs together with the non-Jew to organizations like the Tammany or the Republican Club, but the non-Jew cannot with him belong to the Kehillah. Both ways, double standard, dual code. It is all so very familiar. The Jew insists on the double everywhere. In the Balkans, he insists on double citizenship. He insists on double protection. He insists on a double standard of education. He insists on all his religious rights as strenuously as he insists that all Christian majority rights shall be stamped out in this country. He insists that he shall have his Sabbath and that you shall not have yours. He wants his own social rights and yours too, but he wants you to have your only your own and not his with it. It casts serious doubts on Jewish intelligence that this course should be so seriously pursued, as if on the one hand the humor of the, quote, nerve, and on the other hand the disgusting impudence of it, had never appeared to his consciousness. In New York, therefore, the Jew politically belongs twice, while all non-Jews belong but once, and it can easily be perceived that this is an advantage. In the previous article, it was rehearsed how Tammany besmirched its name by association with the Jews who used the organization as a protection for their traffic in vice. This was in 1894. The revelations were so terrible that in any other community they would have led to a complete abolition of any possible chance of recovery. But as it was never made plain to the people that the traffic in vice was not a sudden appearance of rottenness among Americans, but was the normal activity of an alien racial strain, the moral power of exposure was dissipated. They always covered up their media. I'm reminded yesterday, I was looking at Jezebel.com, one of the Gawker Ring. They were reporting on the riot of 2000 brawling teenagers at a mall in Louisville, which is a site of continual black disturbances. And what was the picture they used to illustrate this black brawling mob? Well, it was shrieking female Beatles fans from 50 years ago, 1964, is made to do service for an article lamenting teens and those wacky teens and their crappy behavior. Not a single word of mention that all these teens were blacks. And that's par for the course in the media where Jews control, and has been apparently for 100 years in one form or another. Not as comprehensive 100 years ago, but wherever it touched the Jewish stuff, it was already the rule. The people were left staggered by what they were allowed to believe about the origin of the horror. People said it was Tammany because the press said it was Tammany, and yet people could not understand how it could be Tammany, and so in the midst of hesitancy, the fire of reform burned out. It was exactly like these days when we were told that, quote, American businessmen, quote, abroad are doing terrible things, yet even while the press declares them to be American, we cannot understand how Americans could do such things, and we never get the key to the matter, nor see the solution, until we stumble on the facts that these so-called Americans are not Americans at all, but alien Jews. Remember, we heard about this earlier in the chapter about Russia and how Jews exercised their power over President Taft to abrogate a treaty that had served us and the Russians faithfully well for decades. Also that the Jews could essentially dominate Russia out of Frankfurt in Germany. Everything is a fake, a cover name or a cover story for the Jew, a pretext. They use Aryan covers in order to perpetrate their crookedness. Over in Canada, the name American is becoming a stigma because it is borne by men who are not Americans. What Canadians point out in the United States as definitely American is mostly Jewish, but how are Canadians to know? The national name suffices, or suffers. The national name suffers. The whole cause of evil is camouflaged, and one nation pays the price of another racial group's misdeeds. There should be some method of protecting this forging of national names. Thus, Tammany became a synonym for what was not characteristically Tammany at all, but what was characteristically Jewish. The exposure of 1894 disclosed that vice was really a thing of cold blood. Evil that springs from passion and impulse really amounts to far less than is commonly supposed. It is when passion is deliberately cultivated and impulse stimulated that the great bulk of the world's social evil occurs. And this stimulation is undertaken in cold blood by those who make profit out of providing the means of gratification, like the old-fashioned barkeepers who served very salty free lunches to simulate the sale of beer. This kind of vice is not a thing to be shamed by exposure, as can be done with involuntary vice, as it might be called. This cold-blooded merchandising of human weakness was merely a matter of profits, and if business had been interfered with by a Lexow committee, L-E-X-O-W, it was rather unfortunate, but good business required that operations be resumed at the earliest possible moment. And so, though the investigations of 1894 were successful and the exposure duly made, it was not to be expected that mere oratory and printer's ink would suffice to keep the serpent down. See, the U.S. are effectively naive amateurs dealing with decades-long practiced professional panders, profiteers, crooked merchants. There's always leap to mind. The Aryan always comes across as the naive, the innocent, and the Jew comes across as the worldly speculator and the worldly dishonest rogue. Will our race ever grow up? I don't know. I'm not sure that it can, frankly. And I've been moved to wonder lately. I mean, what is the distance between black and white should be familiar to all of us. We've all seen blacks and what they're like, but is the distance between white and black less than the distance between white and Jew? I won't answer that. I'll leave you to think about that. It was only 7 years before scandal flamed again, and throughout the length and breadth of New York, and strange enough in all conscience for Gentile fronts of this day and generation to heed, it was found again that the traffic in evil and its ramifications all over the land, and even to foreign countries, was in the hands of the Jews. There was no doubt about it. There was no accident about it. The fact was as continuous as it was colossal. William Travers Jerome, J-E-R-O-M-E, then Justice of the Court of Special Sessions, made in 1901 a ringing indictment of conditions in the city, and used the full power of his court to punish wrongdoers. He even went so far as to specify individuals and political connections, but he did not mention the key word of it all, which was Jew, quote-unquote. It was doubtless wise for him that he did not, else he could not have enjoyed the subsequent political career which came to him. Tammany was defeated in the election of 1901. The defeat was due to the same cause, the stigma of Jew-controlled vice traffic under political protection. It was at this time that Richard Croker, C-R-O-K-E-R, abdicated, quote-unquote. He was a rich man. He sailed for Ireland, and here he became a country squire on his wantage, W-A-N-T-A-G-E, estate. Public curiosity was fed the statement that Croker had selected Lewis Nixon to be his successor, but this turn in Tammany's career is too important to be thus misstated. The truth is that when Croker left, he surrendered Tammany to the Jews. Croker could confirm this if he would talk, if he should be permitted to talk. It is, however, not well to have garrulous old men spilling secrets of other days. Croker, in his age, took a bride who is said to be of Indian descent, and he has not been much in touch with his family nor the public since. Lewis Nixon was the convenient and perhaps unconscious Gentile front. The real ruler of Tammany and Croker's stead was Andrew Friedman, mentioned in the former article as Croker's friend and housemate. Judging from the habit of individual Jews to room with baseball players before the baseball scandal, and the result of another Jew's living with Croker, it might be just as well to keep an eye on those other men who are in position to do favors or influence legislation whose close cronies happen to be Jews. Some of these friendships may indeed be perfectly conceived, but there are numerous instances where the plans of the Jewish friend are completely matured through the agency of the quote-unquote Gentile chum. So beware of any goy who has some degree of power or name or reputation who is in very close quarters an intimate life with some Jew, Buddy. So, upon departure of Croker from these shores, we find Tammany under the dictatorship of a Jew who was Croker's chief influence, if not his absolute master. By the time this occurred, it was useless for Tammany to rebel. Tammany men who had noticed the infiltration of Jews and were alarmed by it had consoled themselves with the thought that, at least, the higher offices were immune from Jewish occupation. This consolation served only to permit the filling of the lower offices by Jews, with less protest from the membership. By the time the Jews were ready to permit Croker to, quote, abdicate, unquote, they had permeated every part of the wigwam, and the assumption of supreme control was thus made a simple matter. Croker stepped aside. Instantly into his place stepped the Jew, Friedman, operating through Nixon. It was too late for Tammany to remonstrate. Tammany could not protest against the wigwam becoming Jewish, because the wigwam already was Jewish. Tammany could not protest against the wigwam becoming Jewish, because the wigwam already was Jewish. To remonstrate, then, was to ruin Tammany. Becoming reconciled to what seemed to be inevitable, Tammany leaders saw that their only hope of survival came through preserving Jewish support. Presently, even Nixon was relegated to the background, and Friedman issued his orders directly. The Jews, however, with great astuteness, continued to make much of Nixon because he was the last thin veil which concealed the change which had overcome Tammany, and he was valuable to that extent. He was, unwillingly, perhaps, their puppet, but even puppets must be accorded their proper dignity. Nixon was tendered a great reception in 1902, but the influential men on the reception committee were mostly Jews. Andrew Friedman was chairman. Then followed the names of Oliver H.P. Belmont, remember that Schoenberg, Rothschild's representative in the U.S. originally, this would be one of his relatives, Max F. Imson, I-H-M-S-O-N, Samuel Untermeyer, Nathan Strauss, Randolph Guggenheimer, Henry Goldfogel, Herman Joseph, and others. On the executive committee of Tammany Hall at this time were Randolph Guggenheimer, Isaac Fromm, Nathan Strauss, Henry Goldfogel, O.H.P. Belmont, and other Jews. On the Committee on Law were Samuel Untermeyer, M. Worlitz Platzek, Abraham Levy, Henry W. Unger, Morris Kukor, and Fred B. House, C-U-K-O-R. Andrew Friedman had complete control of the Committee on Finance that was nominally headed by Lewis Nixon. Randolph Guggenheimer was president of the Municipal Council. Ferdinand Levy was on the Committee on Resolutions and Correspondence. Jews had spread themselves as to constitute a controlling group in all the assembly districts that were under tribute to Tammany. In the Fighting Eighth District, Martin Engel was leader. His chief aide was Manny Eichner, chairman of the Isidore Kahn Association and of the Young Men's Democratic Association. His other assistants, Max J. Porges, Max Levine, and Mo Levy were floor managers of the dances and balls of the Florence Sullivan Association. In the 10th District, Simon Steingut, mayor of 2nd Avenue, was one of the hardest workers in Tammany affairs. Edward Mandel was the active Jewish Tammany man in the 12th District. In the 18th District, Morris Blumenthal was one of the principal workers. He devoted his career chiefly to the training of Jewish speakers for the wigwam. The 18th district was known as the Gas House District, notorious for the gas house scandals over padded payrolls, and here Charlie Murphy ruled, his aides being Julius Simon, Edward E. Slomaski, Joseph Schlesinger, Leopold Worms, Hugo Siegel, Alfred B. Marx, Nathan Fernbacher, and other Jews. And so on through the list. Among the Sachems of the Tammany, the heavyweights of the Tammany Society, there were to be found the wealthier and more socially exalted Jews. However, the Jews made their cyclically recurrent mistakes. They carried things with too high a hand, and a rebellion broke out. It is this Jewish tendency to boast and overdo that has always given the game away. Superficial observers and writers like John Spargo and Norman Hapgood have observed the recurrent periods of protest against Jewish presumption and bumptiousness and have explained them as being recurrent spasms of a vile poison which is supposed to reside in the blood of Gentiles, the vile poison of anti-Semitism. That, of course, is the conventional Jewish propagandist explanation, and Spargo and Hapgood are merely retailing it. They say it always breaks out after wars. Why after wars? Because in wars, the world sees more clearly than at other times the real purpose and personality of the Jew. Thus, it is not anti-Semitism that breaks out. It is Semitism, gross and exaggerated Semitism. And this serum that forms in the body to insist and control the germ of Semitism comes in the form of public exposure and protest. Study history. Study the history of all things whatsoever into which Jews inject themselves, from summer resorts to empires, and you see the same cycle recurring or appearing. And thus it happened in Tammany Hall. Quote, too much Jew, unquote, engendered revolt. Lewis Nixon became aware of his position. As a gentleman of standing and responsibility, he could not continue in a position whose falsity had become clear to him. When he accepted the leadership of Tammany Hall, it was not with a purpose to continue the old order. His understanding was that he was to be left free to restore Tammany to the plane of its former serious purpose and respectable character. He discovered that he was being used as the, quote, respectable Gentile front, unquote, behind whose name the Jews expected to carry on the old game. Therefore, in May 1902, 3 months after the great reception above mentioned, Nixon resigned as leader of Tammany Hall. Doubtless the reception that was tendered him was for the purpose of inducing him to love the exaltation of his position so much that he would sacrifice its moral obligations. Nixon accompanied his resignation with a speech in which he protested that ever since he had accepted the leadership of Tammany, he had been hampered in his every action by a group headed by Andrew Friedman. They dictated the names that were to be placed on a list of sachems. When I rebelled, I found that at every turn I would be opposed by this coterie of interferers. I found that all my important acts had to be approved, before they could become effective. He said he could no longer retain his position and his self-respect. He had to give up one or the other. With this, Mr. Nixon vanished from the scene of Tammany politics. The resignation of Mr. Nixon had a bad effect on the reputation of Tammany with the public. The plan had been to allow him to serve as long as ordinarily, and then replace him with a Jew by means of the usual process of selection. But the resignation, and the explanation that accompanied it, showing as it did the Jewish influence in Tammany, made it seem inadvisable to follow with a Jewish leader. So the district leaders were obliged to find another, quote, Gentile front, unquote, only this time one who would prove sufficiently docile. There was enough rankling disfavor against the Jews in the old organization to warrant this appearance, this observance of appearances, at least. The dictatorship of Friedman was seen to be a failure, much as the dictatorship of Trotsky is seen to be a failure. A rearrangement of committees automatically eliminated him from control. At the same time, the name of Croker was dropped. A triumvirate of leaders was chosen, of whom Charles F. Murphy became and remains the chief. Boss Murphy, he is called. Mr. Murphy has been an ideal front, not attempting to do anything, not attempting to interfere with the Jews doing anything, keeping wisely silent and thereby gaining a reputation of silent wisdom. Mr. Murphy is a millionaire. Those who do the higher Jews' bidding, leaders' bidding, get their reward that way. There is no other reward they can hope for. Certainly they never have a reward of public confidence in the people's gratitude. That is the status of Tammany Hall at the present time. A few of the old guard are left at their posts, but they are officers in name only. Tammany is no longer denounced by the public press, but the Jewish leaders of Tammany live daily to a chorus of praise in the Jewish-controlled newspapers of the United States of New York. Samuel Untermyer, for example, receives more publicity in New York than does the President of the United States, but it is not discriminating publicity. It does not penetrate to the inner purposes and consequences of his actions. Those who were the lesser Jewish lieutenants of Tammany a few years ago have now arrived at posts of influence and affluence. Morris Kukor was made the President of the Municipal Services Commission, to be succeeded by former state senator Abraham Kaplan. Fred B. House rose to be a city magistrate. The city marshals are mostly Jewish. Jews predominate in the College of the City of New York. Jews control the municipal courts, the city magistrates' courts, the city court, the New York State Court of Appeals, the New York State Supreme Court. They rule in the departments enumerated in the fore part of this article. The New York judiciary has a distinctly Semitic complexion. The leadership of the Tammany-controlled districts tells the same story. In the second, the leader is M.S. Levine. In the sixth, David Lazarus. In the eighth, S. Goldenkrantz, F. Bauman, and S. Salinger. In the ninth, Mrs. P. Lau, L.A.U. In the 17th, Nathan Birkin, and so on. The Jewish conquest of Tammany, however, is only one phase of the conquest of New York. The Jewish objective is more than political. Merely to strive that the lucrative and powerful offices of the city shall fall to their people is not the end in view. New York has been turned into the red center of America. There, most of the alien treason carried on against the government of the United States has its source. The United States government has been compelled at times to regard New York as almost alien soil, but even that watchfulness on the part of the national government is relaxed as Jewish influence becomes more potent at Washington. Tammany is a convenient cover for ostensible political activity, as the Kahilla is for the more radical and anti-American racial activity. So behind these fronts of the Kahilla and New York power politics is red organizing, not only for the rest of the world, but for the U.S. as well. At the same time, of course, they're trying to grow their influence in D.C. The United States government, he concludes this article and these two chapters on Tammany Hall and the Jewish takeover thereof, the United States government could not do better than to investigate, through a committee of invulnerable Americans, the Jewish activities of that center. And that there is much to investigate is indicated by the rush of Jews to Washington when it was recently proposed in the United States Senate that such a thing be done. So they don't want the sort of investigation that we've heard about in this article. Show that they're completely controlling New York and its politics and using them to aid their various illegal acts, criminal racketeering. Anyway, that appeared on the 1st of October in 1921 in the Dearborn Independent. So that's chapter 53 and 54 about Tammany Hall. And you can find, as I say, you can find everything that we do recorded at vnnforum.com. And thanks for listening today, and I'll be back with you again real soon.